to follow it through.
Yes, I mean, she had, you know, as you I'm sure will know, her voice changed. You know, she was taught to speak more like a man, to speak more slowly. And she did, in some ways, come across as quite inauthentic. But when you look at the words and you look back at some of the, you know, television appearances that she gave, which I've done, you see, you know, she was just, she really did connect with people, you know, their aspirations, the want, you know, the wish to own their own home, for example. You know, and she was a grocer's daughter. She still had, though I think she began to lose it, that real kind of connection with, you know, not particularly privileged lives. And she said, I mean, she really said what she meant. She did not care about being unpopular.
Caroline, forgive me, because I'm fascinated to hear the memories, but we're going to have to end there because the programme is almost over. And I did want to add just a shout out to Lincolnshire, because Maggie was from Lincolnshire and so am I, and I was determined to say it. That's pretty much it from me today on The Times at One. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. Technical operator was Ryan Boyd. And thanks to both of them. Next on Times Radio, Fee and Jane.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Stephen. And Stephen is back tomorrow with The Times at One on Tuesday. For now, though, it's still Monday, I'm afraid. It is 2 o'clock. It's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover until four.
And in those 2 hours, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas marks a historic dawn of the new Middle East. We'll unpack the US president's triumphant visit to the region, his speech to the Knesset, and ask what aid charities, diplomats, and the people of Israel and Gaza will do next. Closer to home, we need to examine Reform UK's plans to row back a big manifesto. Pledge. We're going to discuss a victory in the battle against AI with the winner of this year's Times Crossword Championship. And Adam Shaw is with us to talk private healthcare as more and more people turn away from the NHS.
Let's get the news at two. Here's Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump's been given a standing ovation in Israel's parliament as he talked of a new dawn in the Middle East. He told the Knesset the long nightmare is finally over for Israelis and Palestinians after phase one of his Gaza peace plan was adopted. Two politicians were thrown out after heckling the US president, with one bearing a sign saying, "Recognize Palestine." Trump ended his hour-long address with these words.
We are going to have hope, harmony, opportunity, and happiness. Israel, America, and all of the nations of the Middle East will soon be safer, stronger, greater, and more prosperous than ever before.
The US president will now travel to Egypt for a summit of 20 world leaders in Sharm el-Sheikh. Sir Keir Starmer, the French president Emmanuel Macron, and the president of the Palestinian Authority Mahmoud Abbas are all expected to attend. The first of some 1,900 Palestinians freed by Israel have begun to arrive by bus in Gaza's Khan Yunis and Ramallah in the West Bank. It follows the return of the 20 living hostages to Israel. Some have been seen in emotional reunions with family members and waving from the roof of a medical centre. The Times of Israel correspondent Tel Schneider says confirmation of their release prompted jubilation in Hostage Square.
In past releases of hostages, you know, the adrenaline makes them look relatively good. But we know from prior releases, it all sinks down after a couple of days and they're all need, you know, they were malnourished, they were emaciated. There's going to be a process of evaluating them. I suppose they will be hospitalized between, you know, 3 to 4 weeks.
In other news, the hard-right political activist Tommy Robinson has told a court he wouldn't share his mobile phone's PIN number as the device contained journalistic material. Officers demanded access under the Terrorism Act as Stephen Yaxley Lennon was stopped at the Channel Tunnel in July last year. The 42-year-old, who's on trial at Westminster Magistrates, denies failing to comply with counter-terrorism powers. Two men have appeared in court charged with the murder of Ian Watkins, the former Lost Prophets singer who was killed on Saturday in prison. 25-year-old Rashid Gaidel and 43-year-old Samuel Dodsworth are both inmates at Wakefield Prison. Watkins was serving a 29-year sentence for child sex offences. Woody Allen has written an emotional tribute to his former on- and off-screen partner, Diane Keaton, who died on Saturday. He starred opposite her in Annie Hall, for which she won the Best Actress Oscar. In an essay published by the Free Press, Allen says her face and laugh illuminated any space she entered. And Margaret Thatcher's Conservative leadership nomination paper from 1975 has been discovered in a forgotten box. It belonged to Sir Edward Ducan, chair of the party's influential committee of backbench MPs at the time. The document, along with other finds, will be auctioned off early next year. Today would have marked the former Prime Minister's 100th birthday. For a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times news briefing on the Times radio app.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. We are here until 4 o'clock. Very happy Monday to you. Welcome aboard our programme. It's a momentous day for the Middle East as the hostages are released, prisoners are freed, and a fresh breeze of hope is definitely in the air. We will talk more about everything that Donald Trump has told us today. Peace through strength was his message. We will have more, and in particular, we on this programme will look to the rebuilding project in Gaza. We're going to cast our eyes in other directions too, though, and reforms promised tax cuts need some scrutiny, so we're definitely going to give you that one. We're going to meet the man who can beat AI at the cryptic crossword. He is the champion. He was crowned in this very building, Jane, over the weekend. I can still feel the tingle, and he's going to tell us how he came up against a machine and he won. More on Prince Andrew's continued fall from grace today as well. Just how low can that man go? There appear to be more and more emails that are coming courtesy of the hack, the tranche, what would you call it? The substantial amount of detail that's been gained from correspondence with the late Jeffrey Epstein. So we'll talk about that too. Books come your way at about 3:45 with the fabulous Laura Hackett. And in Money Matters on a Monday, if in doubt, just use alliteration. Actually, it matters every day, doesn't it? We're going to talk to Adam Shaw about private healthcare because so many more people are taking it out. He's going to tell us if it's worth it, what are the risks, and just how closely you need to read the small print.
So we'll discuss the Middle East very soon, but first a quick look at the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, Nigel Farage blames Keir Starmer after Reform councillor, age 19, is assaulted. This is the Reform UK leader claiming insults hurled at George Finch moments before he was attacked echoed the Prime Minister's rhetoric. The second most read story is the Times live page for Donald Trump's visit to the Middle East. The last of the Israeli hostages held in Gaza were handed over this morning, with the US President praising his team in a speech to the Israeli Parliament. And the most read piece on the Times website is survivor of October the 7th attack found dead. This is such a distressing story, this. Roei Shalav witnessed his girlfriend's murder at the hands of Hamas at the Nova Festival, and he has taken his own life 2 years after that massacre. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need a digital subscription. And if you don't have one, please do get one. Honestly, you won't regret it. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
If you'd like to join us today and you'd like to tell us your thoughts about anything that we're discussing, we are always 0333 003 2353. And if you want to send us an email, we're janeandfee@times.radio.
But let's be honest, this is a day of hope and perhaps a time to be cautiously optimistic. In the words of Donald Trump, the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas marks the historic dawn of a new Middle East. The US president made those comments during an address to the Knesset at lunchtime following the release of the final living hostages from Gaza. We should say as well that hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are returning to the Strip. I can see them now actually in images on the news channels. They're getting back to Gaza, and they have been doing so for the last half hour or so. Now, the comments from Donald Trump followed an opening statement from Benjamin Netanyahu, in which the Israeli Prime Minister heaped praise on the US president.
At the beginning of the war, I promised to bring all the hostages home. Today, with the indispensable help, the determined and focused help, the unremitting help of President Trump and his team, and with the incredible sacrifice and courage of the soldiers of Israel, we are fulfilling that promise.
Well, the US president spoke shortly afterwards and hailed what he called an end to terror and death.
After two harrowing years in darkness and captivity, 20 courageous hostages are returning to the glorious embrace of their families, and it is glorious. 28 more precious loved ones are coming home at last to rest in this sacred soil for all of time. And after so many years of unceasing war and endless danger, today the skies are calm, the guns are silent, the sirens are still, and the sun rises on a holy land that is finally at peace, a land and a region that will live, God willing, in peace for all eternity.
Just a very brief extract from a typically lengthy, and it has to be said, rambling speech from Donald Trump to the Israeli parliament a little while ago. Let's talk to Ariette Kovler, who's a writer and analyst in Jerusalem. Can you pick some of the really significant moments from that speech for us, please?
Well, the most significant message from the Trump speech, which happened a few times, was his continued insistence that the war was over. This is something that Netanyahu and the Israeli government hasn't really said to the public. They've been saying, you know, the hostages are home. But that moment, that kind of official statement that from his point of view, the Gaza war is over, that's something that kind of is something that maybe Netanyahu has been a bit scared to say to the Israeli public. And within that, you know, Trump kind of needling Netanyahu a little bit, saying, you know, it's time to stop all the killing and killing. There's nothing more to do here. And this kind of sense of celebration that he is taking with him down to, as he goes down to Egypt now.
Yeah. Do you think in some ways, and I agree with you, that was repeated several times, wasn't it? Was it effectively a warning to Netanyahu, it is over, do not start anything again on my watch?
I mean, there's certainly an element of that in there, for sure. I mean, the atmosphere was very positive, very friendly, you know, lots of jokes, little dig to Netanyahu that, you know, you're not in a war anymore. You should be nice to the opposition leader, Yair Lapid. Whereas, in fact, them not being in a war anymore might mean the opposite, the return to a nastier politics. You know, Trump also calling for Netanyahu to be pardoned from his criminal trial, asking the president of Israel to pardon him. But I do think that there was this message here, which is, this is my achievement, this ceasefire, don't mess it up.
Yes, I mean, he did say that Netanyahu was one of the greatest wartime prime ministers, and the charges against him, in Trump's words, amounted to just a few cigars and a bit of champagne, and let's just leave it. How did that go down with the audience?
Well, the Knesset was sort of packed with essentially supporters of the government. You know, the gallery, the people in charge of allocating the gallery gave out a lot of tickets reportedly to likely could vote bundlers and people who are going to be needed in a potentially a Likud primary if Israel is heading for elections. That might be a sign that elections are closer than people might have thought. And so there were lots of cheers anytime he said anything popular about the government or anything nice about Netanyahu.
Right, which is a contrast to what was going on outside, where I gather at some points the public address system had to remind people that this whole occasion in these public spaces was about honouring Donald Trump, not being incredibly rude about the elected prime minister.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, the people who have been most active on the streets calling for the release of the hostages have also, not at first actually, but over the last 2 years, become very critical of the Israeli government. There's certainly a sense that Netanyahu had to be dragged kicking and screaming into this deal by Trump. And so they're very grateful to him and very angry at Netanyahu.
And what was said in that speech by Donald Trump about the Palestinians, if anything?
I didn't talk about them very much. He did say that Gaza needs to be rebuilt and that the Gazans have been living and in a bad way for some decades now, you know, referencing the kind of Hamas leadership there and that there should be a better life for them. There was, you know, the kind of nods towards President. There wasn't the kind of explicit head-banging, strong support of a two-state solution that would have isolated and gone down badly, maybe even led to some boos to Trump had he gone down that route. But the kind of more general fluffy talk around Gaza peace in the lead up to the Sharm summit. That was something that was understood, I think, by some in the room as kind of being that nod towards a two-state thing. And we saw this interesting thing. Netanyahu announced a few hours ago And then he got a formal invite from the Egyptian president al-Sisi, mm-hmm. that he was going to go to the Sharm summit after all. And then after about an hour, suddenly that was all off. He changed his mind. He's too busy. And there's the Jewish festival. It's not going to work. And that was because there was a bit of a backlash inside his coalition amongst his more right-wing partners that this conference was a bit too pro-Gaza, a bit too pro-two-state solution, and he couldn't be seen to be involved.
Right, which is an illustration, if we needed one, that the road ahead is not particularly easy, and the solution to the very many, many problems not clear at all.
No, even this afternoon, there's a new wrinkle. The next stage of transfers of hostages was supposed to be actually the bodies of hostages that Hamas have been holding for the last 2 years. They're supposed to give back a reasonable number of those today. Supposedly, they're saying they could only find four today. That's a lot less than Israel had been led to believe would be handed back today. And now there's kind of urgent talks going on about what this means for this current tranche of prisoner releases. There's a lot of challenges ahead, and they're already starting.
And as for Palestinian representation at this summit in Egypt, who is there?
Well, no one was invited initially. Notably, no Israelis, no Palestinian representation, no Hamas, no Palestinian Authority. But over the last, I think it was about 48 hours, Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, managed to get an invite, essentially managed to invite himself there. Still no Hamas. And that was a big diplomatic move. I believe he's already there on the ground in Sharm. And that's partly the reason, I think, that we saw a move by Netanyahu to try and go before he realised the backlash that would cause.
Right. So how confident are you on a scale of 1 to 10 that something really solid is going to come out of these conversations in Egypt, bearing in mind that there is no direct Israeli representative there, or certainly not that we're aware of, and certainly not the Prime Minister, and nobody from Hamas or affiliated to it?
Well, I mean, this is supposed to be about the future of Gaza. Obviously, it has a broader regional meaning too. These conferences, they normally take months to pull together. They have pre-meetings, they have, you know, what they call PrepCons, preparatory conferences, which are full of the people they call Sherpas, you know, kind of diplomats who do all the kind of nitty-gritty negotiations, so they can leave only a few big questions and some signings on the table. This isn't that. This whole thing was pulled together in 2 or 3 days. I assume it's basically going to be a pep rally, for want of a better word, to try and get some energy around a future for Gaza. And everyone's celebrating and clapping and saying, oh, isn't it great that there's a ceasefire? Well done, Donald Trump. The likelihood that there's going to be anything concrete out of it is very small, but perhaps it could be the start of a more substantive process.
Well, let's all hope so. Thank you very much for your time, Aryeh Kovler, who's a writer and an analyst, and he was joining us from Jerusalem. Dr. James Smith is an emergency care doctor who's worked in Gaza. He is a lecturer in humanitarian studies at University College London. Dr. Smith, I mean, it's impossible to think about the situation in Gaza without pondering on what the priorities should be to try to help people who've gone back to what remains of their homes. What do they need first?
What we're talking about here is a state of total and complete destruction. And the footage that we've seen of people returning to Gaza City and the north of Gaza in particular in the last couple of days reveals, as we've seen repeatedly over the course of the last 2 years, the complete destruction of residential neighbourhoods. In places, there is literally nothing standing. We're talking about people's most basic needs simply to survive from one day to the next. I think it's really important that we emphasise that while the direct military violence from Israel may have stopped, the conditions that have been imposed, the conditions of life intended to bring about the destruction in whole or in part, still stand. We're talking about tens of thousands of people who are severely, acutely malnourished. They need specialist nutritional supplements in order to survive. The entire healthcare system has been targeted and systematically undermined. And a healthcare workforce, of course, that is exhausted beyond comprehension. physically and emotionally and psychologically.
Forgive me if you don't know, I don't want to interrupt you because I know you've got first-hand experience of this, but is there a working water supply? Does the sewage system work?
Absolutely everything that is required for basic sort of societal functionality has been undermined. The water and sanitation systems were extremely fragile under the conditions of occupation and have been targeted. Many of your listeners may recall footage, particularly harrowing footage from Rafah last year, where Israeli soldiers filmed themselves blowing up the water and sanitation, one of the main water and sanitation systems in Rafah. So the infrastructure has been destroyed. In the short term, that will require effectively trucking of clean water, such that we can stave off the spread of waterborne diseases, which is widespread at the moment. Refuse, of course, piling up everywhere because there's no functioning waste disposal system. Agricultural and food security systems, livelihoods, of course, completely decimated, olive groves destroyed. OCHA, the UN Office for the High Commissioner for Humanitarian Affairs, have prepared with Palestinian organizations and Palestinian civil society a 60-day plan. And effectively, what we're seeing there is just a long list of all of the most basic requirements that must be covered. For most of us, it's impossible to comprehend. More than 600,000 school-age children that have been denied access to education for 2 years. Back in January, the World Health Organization estimated that $10 billion US dollars would be required for health system recovery alone. Of course, that number will have doubled now, given that the violence continued. Huge, huge needs, not only in the short term, but over the long term as well.
And of course, we do need to be mindful that there is still violence on the ground in Gaza. Reports of clan warfare, for example, a particular disagreement between Hamas and a family who play some significant role in a clan in the Gaza Strip. I mean, that poses a very real danger to the civilian population as well, doesn't it?
I mean, the violence hasn't stopped. We have to be aware that there are several proxies that Israel itself has admitted arming over the course of the last 2 years. There are various proxies that are operating still inside Gaza. And of course, violence manifests beyond direct military violence. So while the drones may have stopped momentarily, while the naval vessels and the warplanes aren't firing onto Gaza, violence manifests in its structural form. And this is a really important issue for us to engage with, perhaps as a segue from the last interviewer. You know, we're talking about a peace plan here, so-called peace plan. And yet the underlying conditions of occupation, of apartheid, of what many people, sociologists, genocide experts and so on, have referred to as slow genocide, these foundational underlying conditions haven't been addressed. And the plan as it's being brokered at the moment really makes no attempt to engage seriously with those underlying conditions, nor the importance of pursuing both accountability and, by extension, justice. And these are really foundational issues if we want to take seriously the pursuit of peace.
Thank you very much. That is the view of Dr. James Smith, who was an emergency care doctor who has worked in Gaza.
We will talk more about the rebuilding of Gaza on this programme after 3 o'clock. But coming up, we're going to head to Cheltenham to hear what's on the agenda today at the town's fabulous literature festival. We're going to do this with Callum MacDonald. If he was a gladiator, his gladiator name would be Enthusiasm. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. We're with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
It's the world's longest-running literature festival, showcasing literary legends, fresh new voices and the biggest books of the year. The Times, Sunday Times and Times Radio Cheltenham Literature Festival is back for 2025. And Times Radio will bring you all the sights and sounds of the festival direct from Cheltenham. From the stars of stage and screen to incisive political debate, hear everything the festival has to offer throughout the Times Radio schedule. And this Wednesday from noon, Hugo Rifkin brings you a special PMQs Unpacked, live from Cheltenham, only on Times Radio.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
The Monopoly game at McDonald's is back. Play today with the Philly Cheese Stack, so you can enjoy two beef patties, crispy grilled onions, and a melted cheddar cheese sauce. Go on, it's your go. From 11 a.m. until the 21st of October, participating in restaurants, subject to availability, app may be required. 18 plus, UK, see mcdrules.co.uk.
The world is vast, offering endless possibilities. But Claire's world has only been getting smaller. She doesn't leave the country. She barely leaves the house. Still traumatised by that roadside bomb in Iraq. More than 20 years ago. For many, the battle continues. Combat Stress provides intensive mental health treatment to UK veterans with complex mental health problems, helping them rediscover the world they once knew. Combat Stress, for veterans' mental health. Search Combat Stress to support our work.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wickes.co.uk.
Now let's head to the Times and Sunday Times Cheltenham Literature Festival, where we will be broadcasting our live show this Thursday. Our guest is who, Jane Garvey?
Penny Lancaster.
What's she talking about?
Well, I was about to list her attributes. She's a special constable. She's a menopause czarina, isn't she? Speaks very positively about women and our suffering, Fee, but somehow we struggle through, keep on going. In fact, we've peaked in our menopausal years, really. But anyway, that's a side issue. Penny Lancaster, also, she is a well-known television presenter on Loose Women, and she's married to a very important rock star.
Thank you for that summary. If you're joining us at Cheltenham, do come and say hello. It would be lovely to have a chat with you. Times Radio's Callum McDonald is already there. What's on the agenda today, Callum?
Hello, Fee. Welcome to a slightly grey but autumnal Cheltenham Literature Festival. It's very nice here, actually. I've never been before, so I'm very much settling in and getting my bearings. I'm stood in front of the Times and Sunday Times Forum, basically a giant tent where about 20 minutes ago 700 people emerged after listening to our beloved and esteemed colleagues Patrick Maguire, chief political commentator of the Times, Gabriel Pogrand, Whitehall editor of the Sunday Times, and our very own Aisha Hazarika of Times Radio Drive on Saturdays and Sundays from 4 till 7 p.m., which she took great delight in reminding the audience of many, many times. We had 700 people emerge from this forum having enjoyed listening to their insider take on the Starmer government so far. I've been speaking to a few of the people who emerged from the audience, and actually, I think it's fair to say that the insight provided by Patrick and Gabriel on stage this afternoon went some way to filling in the gaps that perhaps members of the audience had. So their perception was confirmed. A government which is perhaps struggling to tell a story, winding itself up in wrong policy decision-making. But the insight given by Gabriel and Patrick, and Aisha, to be fair, added in more detail as to the personnel and the politics, or lack of politics, of Sir Keir Starmer. So that's been a highlight for me for today. A little bit later on, I'm going to browse this Waterstones, which is just beside me, and is heaving with books, and indeed with people mingling around it even as we speak. And just down the path there, beyond the brown leaves of these glorious trees here in Cheltenham, is the Sunday Times Wine Club bar area, which I'm thoroughly, thoroughly looking forward to exploring later, and hoping for some staff discount of some kind as well.
Well, I'm sure the fabulous Will Lyons will see you coming and he'll have a jug prepared for you. You're absolutely right. That Waterstones is the home of tote bags and erudite conversation, isn't it? It's always busy. You usually get a chance for a book signing with the author if you've attended one of the events. You've also been talking to the author Claire Lynch, I know, about the motivation behind her debut novel, which is called A Family Matter. Shall we have a listen, Callum?
So I was writing a novel about a family, I suppose, and trying to work out what was going on in this dynamic where a mother was absent from the family. And then when I came across these court cases, I mean, shocked is the right word, I think, really, to realise how recently these cases were happening. So through the 70s, the 80s, even to the early 90s, what would happen in this country is, you know, sometimes a mother falls in love with another woman, it happens. Yeah. And whereas now that family might reconfigure in a different way, we're used to step families and blended families, then the very idea that this had happened was seen as evidence that she was unsuitable to be a mother. So mothers lost custody of their children, and lots of times it was kind of kept a secret even from the children themselves. So that real story felt like a little mission, really, for me to kind of put that into this fictional family's world.
It sounds like very powerful stuff. And Claire Lynch is in conversation with Florence Knapp, isn't she, who wrote The Names, which I think is one of the best debut novels I have ever read. Is that session still going on now, Callum?
Yes, that is on right now at The Hive, 2 till 3pm, that one. And they are both actually featuring, both Florence and Claire, featuring as part of the Cheltenham Literature Festival's spotlight on new voices. So yes, debut novels, absolutely. But it's about bringing these people to the fore, putting them on stage at such an important event as this to discuss what has driven them to write these books. I found Claire really fascinating. And the story that she had chosen to tell, that she stumbled across, about a mother who falls in love with another woman, and that fragments a family. But there's such pain in there too for the father in that family, who has to, well, decide how best to respond. And he does what I guess is kind of an instinctive fatherly approach to things. He decides not to tell his daughter in that moment, by way of a motivation to protect her. But of course, as Claire writes in her book, that leads to all sorts of difficulties. And she writes it in such a way that there's kind of two parallel timelines running throughout the novel. So one is from the 1980s, when this story was sort of happening. And she's also done it from 2022, where these family members are now. It's very cleverly done. And it was a really interesting conversation with her as part of the New Voices focus here at the Cheltenham Literature Festival.
Well, those are two brilliant examples of the different types of events that you can see at Cheltenham, aren't they? You can find out all about modern day politics from people who really know their stuff, and then you can join in a conversation with two fabulous writers trying to sort the world out through fiction. There's an Agatha Christie slot today at 3:30 featuring David Suchet in conversation with Anne Cleves, favourite of this programme. They're chatting to Mike Gale about Christie's literary reputation. There's plenty more available that you can find just by looking at the website. Jane and I will be there on Thursday, Callum. We're veterans of the Cheltenham Literature Festival. Both of us really enjoy the experience. I don't know about Jane. I find the snacking at the festival particularly exciting. Do you?
And relentless.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Because in between every event, you think, I can have a flapjack now.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm going to raid the brisket stall over there a little bit later on, I think, as a sort of mid-afternoon power-up.
Can I just suggest to you, I don't know if you've got access to some sort of iron, but the Times banner behind you, Callum, it's blowing, and it's sort of flapping around there in what it looks like a quite light breeze in Cheltenham. It does need a going over with an iron. It's very ruffled.
Yeah, I'm really glad you weren't talking about my shirt, which had a bit of attention this weekend with an iron. So no, I can confirm the creased nature of the banner behind me.
Yeah.
It says shaping cultural debate on it. Mm. Yeah, but some things about that banner do need ironed out. You're absolutely right, Jane.
Thank you. I think
that that's not a cotton fibre, so I don't think you should take an iron to that. I think that would be trouble.
It feels a little bit like a football shirt, if that helps.
It does help. I feel that we've covered some ground. It's always lovely to talk to you. Callum will be at the Cheltenham Festival. You see him, go and say hello. He's ever so friendly.
Yeah, well, we did. Was it the first year we went to Cheltenham? We did the programme from the bookshop. People kept asking us for directions and indeed trying to buy books from us. And we kept having to take off our headsets and say, no, we're not here. We don't know.
It is true that after a certain age, if you sit behind a desk with a headset on, you just look like you're a help desk. And we did.
Exactly. But as regular listeners will know, we can't help anybody with anything. Right, this is Times Radio. Reform UK are expected to scrap a key manifesto pledge promising huge tax cuts. I wonder why. Let's talk to pollster Scarlett Maguire. First, just after 2:30, here are the headlines. Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has now departed Israel for Egypt after a speech to the Knesset where he promised a new dawn for the Middle East. This morning, all 20 remaining living hostages seized by Hamas were handed over to the Red Cross ahead of emotional reunions with their families. In exchange, nearly 2,000 freed Palestinian prisoners have arrived in the West Bank and Gaza. Asil Baydoun is from the charity Medical Aid for Palestinians. She told Times Radio they hope more aid will come into Gaza tomorrow.
We're still talking about famine conditions across Gaza. The healthcare sector is completely dismantled. So the situation in terms of the humanitarian situation is still as catastrophic as it was before the ceasefire, as Israel is still controlling the border. And us as international organizations, we don't have yet the permission to access fully the borders.
Elsewhere, Tommy Robinson has told a court he wouldn't give up the PIN for his phone because he didn't want police to see his journalist material. The activist denies failing to comply with counter-terrorism powers. The internet forum 4chan has become the first website to be fined under the Online Safety Act. Regulator Ofcom says the platform failed to provide information about the risk of illegal content being on it. It's been told to pay £20,000. And more than 40 people have died in a bus crash in South Africa. It's not yet clear what caused the vehicle to career down a steep embankment north of Pretoria. Don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
We were a noisy generation, but it might be something quiet we do that becomes our greatest legacy. Leave a gift in your will to the British Heart Foundation and fund groundbreaking research that could help save millions of lives. Search BHF Wills.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
I want to see more of the world, so I need my investments to do the same. FNC Investment Trust searches out the world's leading companies and puts my money to work from the UK to the US and Asia. All through one simple investment. So when it's time to say goodbye work, I'll be saying, hello world.
Find FNC on all major investment platforms. It's smart to start with FNC. Capital at risk. This FNC Investment Trust advert is approved for distribution by Columbia Threadneedle Management Limited, February 2025.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
It is 24 minutes to 3 o'clock. It's an incredibly busy day. It's a really important day of news as well. And John Peanut will be here at 4 o'clock to guide you through events and to, I suppose, by then, just look back a little bit on all the things that have been said today, John.
For sure. And also look at what's going to be happening when we come on air. I mean, just a minute ago, literally a minute ago, Donald Trump took off from Ben Gurion Airport in Israel on his way to Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. And we saw what happened at the Knesset a little earlier on this morning. I mean, that absolute, you know, mutual praise and celebration, fulsome praise. And this is, isn't it, a moment to be glad of. It's a moment to be deeply relieved of, and people will feel both of those things. I mean, you would not know, watching the Knesset earlier on, that Benjamin Netanyahu had had to be forced into the deal today by Donald Trump, because that's what happened. How long will it last? I mean, I don't think it's possible to know that. It is possible to try to empathise with the hostage families who are now seeing something they dared believe was going to happen. They are seeing their loved ones now released by Hamas, and the Palestinians who need not live tonight in fear of being destroyed by an Israeli attack. And that's something too. But, you know, all of that on the other side, you've now got tens of thousands of Palestinians heading back to their homes across the border, where a lot of them, maybe 10,000 people, are going to be going through rubble with bare hands trying to find the bodies of their families. So, you know, it is not a moment for pure celebration, even by us, who are so far removed from the real agony and the danger of what has been. So we're going to be watching all of that, the events in Sharm el-Sheikh, the signing, the words that come out of the political leaders there. I'm going to be talking to various people, Gabriel Weininger and also Angel Pfeffer. And if you want better commentators in Israel, on Israel, I don't know who on earth they are. I'm talking to a UNICEF representative in Gaza City who can tell us something about what it is like in that, what's left of that place. Now, to a Middle East former envoy and to Lord Ricketts, the former head of the diplomatic service in the United Kingdom. So we should get a pretty seasoned, measured between all of them and more of what is going on now and what might happen in the future.
Lovely stuff, John. Thank you very much. John starts at 4 o'clock, just after we finish.
Yes, I was just looking at more of those scenes from Gaza with the Palestinian prisoners being reunited with their families. And, you know, the thing that strikes you is just how similar those reunions are, of course, to the ones between the Israeli hostages and their families. We are all the same deep down underneath all the political rhetoric and all those hardline emotions and feelings surrounding all this, but people are just throwing themselves at their relatives, whether they've been released from captivity or released from jail in the case of the Palestinian prisoners. The relief on the faces of the relatives, whether Israeli or Palestinian, it's absolutely incredible. And it's the same, because they're human. Anyway, you didn't need to hear that, but now you have. Nigel Farage is dropping Reform UK's manifesto promise of massive tax cuts in a bid to increase its economic credibility. The party had pledged to cut £90 billion in taxes, something both Labour and the Conservatives had attacked as simply not credible. Now, Reform's deputy leader Richard Tice has spoken to Times Radio Breakfast, and he blamed the change on the UK's altered financial situation.
Well, look, a manifesto is based on a point in time. The principles behind it are absolutely rock solid. We said we've got to make very significant savings in order to fund a different way to run the economy. What's happened since then is that the state of the economy, because of the mismanagement by this Labour government, the numbers have got far worse. And we will be focusing relentlessly, as I've been saying, on the savings.
Right, that's Richard Tice, who says it's all Labour's fault. Scarlett Maguire is a pollster and the director of Merlin Strategies. Scarlett, at the moment, what do the public think of Reform's economic policies and performance?
They don't think very much of it at all. So one thing that you hear quite a lot in focus groups with voters that would be are either supporting Reform or thinking about supporting Reform is that they're unsure what their economic plans are. And for most voters, this is a negative thing. I think there is an argument to say, a little bit like Labour did before the last election, that if you don't say anything, you also can't alienate people. But we've also seen that doesn't necessarily work that well the other side of the election. So no, at the moment, voters don't really understand what Reform plans are. And we do see, especially amongst Conservative voters, it tends to be one of their biggest hesitations about sort of crossing the Rubicon and going to vote for Nigel Farage, is this sense that they might not be economically conservative or responsible with the economy.
Just in the last couple of days, we've heard something about the Reform-run councils who have come out and said, look, you know, we've sent our mini doges in. And the uncomfortable truth is we can't find those savings we thought we'd be able to. And guess what? We're going to have to put up council tax. Do you think that's going to affect the way Reform is regarded by its potential voters?
I think individual councils and what happens on them doesn't tend to have much impact. And we've seen this even with devolved governments in places like Wales and Scotland, although we might see a sort of political reckoning coming that way in those upcoming elections in May. But it's remarkable how long councils can hold out against these sorts of things, or rather that a national brand can remain sort of shielded against what those local councils are doing. So I think that will be less important. But I think it is very interesting that they're making this new play for economic competency, because it does feel like a logical next step for them if they want to sustain or even push forward their momentum.
But OK, then, if Reform don't have this promised war on waste, apparently, or the suggestion was always that that would lead to tax cuts, and that is appealing to lots of us. What have they got? What's in their locker?
Well, goodness, I don't know. But it is, yeah, it'd be interesting to see, because I think they could go, there's two conflicting forces there. You can see that when you map their voters on a spectrum of how economically versus socially left-wing, right-wing they are, you can see that sort of socially, culturally, on questions like immigration, that they're all pretty right-wing. It might not surprise you, but they're all pretty aligned on that. What they are not aligned on is the economy. And this is because they're actually pulling voters from all over the place, all around the country, all different political persuasions. And so voters are completely torn on what they want on the economy. Some of them, an important part, those they're getting from Labour, want a very big state and more money for the NHS and probably more tax rises with it. Some of them feel the complete opposite of that. And I think that's part of the reason why there's quite a lot of uncertainty as to which direction they'll go in.
Right. So confusion, frankly, serves them well. And because they haven't ever been in government, I can completely understand why some people would regard them as an alternative. That kind of desperation of, well, they haven't had the chance to fail, so why don't we just give them a whirl?
Exactly. It's the last roll of the dice. Like the best thing Reform have going for them. Part of it is Nigel Farage's celebrity, which sounds like an odd thing to say about someone who is still very polarising, although he has become more popular. But his celebrity and his cut through counts for an awful lot, especially as we're now starting to see with younger generations. But mostly what Reform have got going for it, as well as saying Nigel Farage's celebrity and name recognition, is the fact that they are not the others. They're not the people in power now. They're not the people that were in power before. And so therefore, they have none of the responsibility for what's been happening with the country. And that is a massive boon for them when so much of the public feel that the country is headed in the wrong direction and has been for quite some time.
And how do voters regard the other parties' attacks on Reform?
I think so far those attacks haven't landed yet. It'll be interesting to see whether so now Kemi Badenoch didn't necessarily attack Reform, but she did make a play on the economy of her own with that sort of pledge to abolish stamp duty and saying about how they were the ones that could be trusted with the economy. We saw attacks from Keir Starmer saying that it was a choice between division and renewal, and they criticised some of Reform's policies for being racist. At the moment, I think, even though it's a little bit early to see about Kemi Badenoch, there are signs that could be starting to rehabilitate the Conservative brand, but I think it will take quite a lot more than what we saw last week. For Labour, I think what we can see in the polls that have come out since conference is at the moment that did not work. I think it can work in theory to say that, you know, an individual policy is racist, but the problem is that often gets lost in transmission, and it's quite a risky strategy because a lot of voters will feel that the attack is on them personally,
right.
Especially a lot of those sort of Brexit voting ones. So at the moment, I think those attacks aren't landing. I also saw, there are rumours that they might pin the tax rises on Farage and Brexit. I also think that would be quite a hard one to land.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that was something that sort of came out at the weekend as something that certainly Keir Starmer is thinking about. People do often refer to the cost of Brexit, and people have asked over the years, why hasn't Nigel Farage been asked much more frequently about the price the country has paid for the policy he essentially drove through? I appreciate he's never been Prime Minister, but you know what I mean. Why hasn't he been held to account for that?
I think it's simply because he's not been in power. People are much readier to blame the politicians that are sitting directly in front of them. This is part of the problem that Labour have. I think Labour thought they had more of a window to blame the Conservatives, the previous lot, than them, when they don't realise that most voters are a little bit more straightforward than that and just think, oh, well, you're in charge now, it's your mess to sort out. And I think there's quite a lot of that with Nigel Farage and Brexit. He has also been quite adept at not talking about it. If you look at the things he stopped talking about, especially over the last year, Brexit is one of them. Another one has been Donald Trump. He's actually talking, this is a slight exception in the last couple of days because of the news coming out of the Middle East and Trump's role in that. But in general, he has wanted to stay clear of his close relationship to that part of American politics and the American right. And likewise, he's not been talking about Brexit. So I think you can see he sees it as a potential political weakness. However, I still think it's probably a bit of a leap for a lot of voters to blame Farage rather than Reeves for any tax rises, for example, that might come.
OK, and the budget looms. I was going to say looms large. I mean, it's still actually weeks away.
It's about 6 weeks.
Yeah. We seem to have been talking about it for, 18 months at least. Any word on what might tickle the fancy of some disgruntled people who voted Labour back in the July of 2024?
I think it's not likely to be a budget filled with sort of carrots rather than sticks. It does seem like there might be some tax rises on the way. We don't know what they keep ruling out the central ones about their manifesto promises about VAT, insurance and income tax. However, there might be a series of other ones. In terms of gifts to the electorate, I mean, there might be that stop to their own backbenchers about the two-child benefit cap. We've had the deputy, people competing for deputy leader, including Bridget Phillipson, calling for go. And there seem to be some signs they might do that to encourage their own voters to their left to stick with them. But it's unclear because Rachel Reeves does not have much room to manoeuvre here.
OK, the line's going a little bit wonky, so we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, Scarlett. Scarlett Maguire is a pollster and the director of Merlin Strategies.
In fact, it was 6 weeks and 2 days until your budget-tasticness, and right, we will be covering it live here on Times Radio. There have been so many things run up that flagpole to gently flutter in the breeze, haven't there, Jane? And I wonder how many more policies are to come.
Well, a lot of people I need to be careful about this. A lot of people of my age have started to flap about this amount of money you can take out of your pension. If you're lucky enough to have one, that tax-free sum, could it possibly? It's 25% at the moment you can take out tax-free, isn't it?
It is. Have you flapped and done something?
Flapped. I very rarely do anything, but I do flap a lot. I probably am at the flapping stage. I think there's plenty of official advice that says do nothing until you know what's going to happen. And even if they do it, even if Rachel Reeves does do it, it will be tapered, won't it?
Well, it may well be tapered. Tom MacPhail, who is the pensions genius, he wrote a very interesting article in The Times a couple of weeks ago about the fact that he'd taken out his tax-free allowance.
Oh, he's taken it out.
Coming up, our
remember when we used to have a laugh and now we talk about tapering and pensions?
I'm still having a laugh. Coming up, our cryptic crosswords, the next frontier to be conquered by AI bots. We're going to talk to a champion puzzle solver. It is a human. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18+ UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
This is the sound of learning in India, a healthy dose of happiness in South Sudan, and a full tummy in Hertfordshire. Poverty, conflict, and the climate crisis are hitting children hard. Save the Children operate in the UK and over 100 countries worldwide, helping the next generation to stay safe, healthy, and learning. By leaving a gift in your will, you'll help fund our life-saving work, giving children around the world more reasons to laugh. Gifts in wills allow us to respond quickly when disaster strikes. They help us to deliver vital healthcare. They give children the chance to heal emotional wounds, to rebuild confidence, to laugh and smile again. At Save the Children, we believe childhood shouldn't just be survived, but enjoyed. And for us, nothing says success like this. Help to give children the best start in life by leaving a gift in your will. Search Save the Children, Gifts in Wills. Save the Children is a registered charity.
You want work to be less hard work. You hear an ad for MHR, so you reach out. We connect your department systems, which leads to real-time data sharing that uncovers new insights, which empower your decision makers and triple monthly sales, which leads to high fives and awkward hugs. You say a big thank you. We say you're welcome. MHR, the science behind HR, payroll and finance. The science behind a new world of work. Discover more at mhrglobal.com.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
We were having such an interesting conversation off-air about pensions. I was late. I was late to the junction. Artificial intelligence can crunch mountains out of data in seconds, write complex code and even compose music, though some people might contest the last one. But when it comes to cracking a cryptic crossword, it's no match for 14-time winner of the Times Crossword Championships, Mark Goodliffe. He retained his title this weekend, not only beating fellow humans, but an artificial intelligence program called Darmok, proof that some challenges do still need a human touch. Mark joins us now. A very good afternoon, Mark, and huge congratulations.
Thank you very much, Fee. Very kind of you.
What do you win?
There's a £1,000 prize, as well as a trophy to take home.
Fantastic. I hope it's a decent trophy, not one of those tinky-winky little ones.
No, it's a nice big silver-looking one.
Brilliant. How did it feel to outsmart the machine? Did you feel quite confident that you would?
One doesn't know, because AI is coming on so quickly that although I knew about a year ago it wasn't doing much with cryptic clues, there's every chance that by now it will have done. And if it didn't this time, maybe next month it'll be a lot better. So you couldn't be sure whether the AI is going to win. I mean, let's be clear, it wasn't actually entered in the competition.
No, but it's a kind of add-on that we're concentrating on, isn't it?
Of course.
So that's an interesting point, isn't it? That the more these large language learning machines can scrape the genius of brains like yours, the more likely they are to be able to outsmart brains like yours. That's the point, isn't it?
Well, I guess, yes. They're trying to learn off all of us. And this is a particular field where they haven't really been pointed at it for a while, and at last sort of a couple of people have started a project to see if they can tackle cryptic crosswords, which is, it's a very interesting area, to be honest. I was involved with an AI company earlier in the year called Sakana in Japan, who are trying much the same with variant Sudoku, which is something that I also take part in. So they think that's the next kind of frontier, and it's very interesting to see what AI can achieve.
Well, it certainly is. And so with your knowledge of what it takes within your brain to solve variant Sudoku and also cryptic crosswords, should we be alarmed that machines will be able to follow that kind of brain pattern?
Well, I guess it depends on your overall approach to AI. If you come from a standpoint that it could help humanity, then you should be pleased that it can cope with the various different types of brain power that humanity is involved in. But if you're nervous that robots will take over the world and there'll be no place left for humans, then maybe we should be alarmed. But that's really very much down to the viewer, I think, rather than the AI.
Which one are you?
I'm probably more the former. I think AI is to be encouraged if it can help us live our lives, and if it can take the grunt work out of lives, then great. I'm not worried that AI is going to take over solving cryptic crosswords, because it won't get any fun out of it, whereas I will.
And what do you think it is that means you can solve these clues so spectacularly quickly? What have you got that, with all honesty, Jane and I haven't?
Well, I've got thousands of hours of experience of practice, and, you know, sadly, the very boring mantra is practice makes better. And that's definitely the case in solving cryptic crosswords. I mean, I do also have a brain that happens to be quite good at pattern matching words and sort of seeing how they break down and so on. For instance, I know that your name is an absolute gift to crossword setters, because you can separate it differently into Fig Lover instead of Fee Glover, which implies that you're a keen fruit fan. But it's just how you look at words, I think.
Yeah, it is true, actually, Mark. I was the answer to exactly that clue, but it was in The Guardian. In what?
I've seen it, yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, I can't mention that again because I'll be taken off air. Now, tell us a little bit about what happened on Saturday and the competition, because actually you did yourself proud in this, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I was delighted with the result. The crosswords were very hard. The format of the competition is sort of exam conditions. You sit in a big room with 120 other people and a script, and you have up to an hour to solve 3 times cryptic crosswords. The quickest 50-odd who are all correct go into a second round, then the quickest 5, and then there's an sort of on-stage final shootout over 1 puzzle.
Okay. Do you get nervous?
A little, because, yeah, the competition's always very good, and you're you know, there is a bit of build up to it, and you're then sat there with a puzzle, and if your brain goes blank, you've got nothing and you look a fool. So there is a worry about that, certainly.
And it must be quite strange having other people around you, because I would have thought one of the absolute joys of doing the crossword is it's complete me time, isn't it?
That's true to an extent. It is most of the time. I mean, I have the benefit that on my YouTube channel, we go through a difficult puzzle every week on Cracking the Cryptic on a Friday and teach people how to do cryptic crosswords. So there you're talking to people about how they work. But that's about the only interaction I would ever have with anyone solving a puzzle. And it's quite one way.
Sure. And do you worry that because you've got so good at this art form, you will actually stop enjoying it as much? Because presumably if there are patterns in all of the clues, there's not so much of a kind of air of joy that you can solve them.
I don't find that. I was having a discussion with some other quite quick solvers who were saying how frustrated they get when somebody says to them, oh, I'd much prefer to take my time and savor every clue rather than you guys who are rushing at speed and don't appreciate them. And we don't think that's true at all. We think we appreciate them just as much, only a little bit quicker.
So you're very good at the crosswords, you're very good at the numbers, you're a former financial
He's
director.
A spy.
Yeah, what are you bad at, Mark?
Oh, I'm bad at all normal things, like talking to people and finding out where my keys are.
No, you're good at that.
And no, I'm terrible at social interaction. And, you know, ask my wife what I'm bad at. There's a litany.
Oh, well, is she there?
She's not. She's not on hand. No, you'll have to dial her up.
Can you make pastry?
No.
Okay.
No, I can't.
No. Right, well, nor can I. So there you are.
We didn't bring you on to tell you, Dan. I apologise for asking you that question.
That's fine.
I think it's a really, really interesting break. Obviously, Mark is blessed with a very different and very speedy thinking brain. Good for him. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I think it's a bit funny of the other the crossworders who like to take their time. They're not that good at crosswords, are they? I mean, I speak as someone who can't do one, so... But to carpet people who can do it quickly, it seems a bit ridiculous.
Well, many congratulations, Mark. It's lovely
Thank
to talk
you.
To you. Mark Goodliffe is the winner of the Times Crossword Championship 2025.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon. It is 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here on Times Radio. And in the next hour, Donald Trump is set to land in Egypt any moment now to meet world leaders for a peace summit. We'll explore what the future governance of Gaza may look like and how our aid money can help. And how much lower can he go? The Duke of York is the person in question, of course. I'll be talking to the author of the book about Prince Andrew and the Duchess of York, entitled, that is, Andrew Lowney. He's on this programme in the next hour. And we'll talk to business journalist Adam Shaw about whether or not you should consider getting private health care. Is it worth the money? Here's the news at 3, Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump is travelling from Israel to Egypt after a speech at the Knesset where he promised the long nightmare is finally over for Israelis and Palestinians. In a speech lasting more than an hour, the US president hailed members of his team and hinted that a deal with Iran may be possible.
And after so many years of unceasing war and endless danger, today the skies are calm, the guns are silent, the sirens are still, and the sun rises on a holy land that is finally at peace, a land and a region that will live, God willing, in peace for all eternity.
The first of some 1,900 Palestinians freed by Israel have begun to arrive by bus in Gaza and the West Bank. It follows the return of the 20 living hostages to Israel. Some have been seen in emotional reunions with family members and waving from the roof of a medical centre. The armed wing of Hamas says the first 4 bodies of hostages will be handed over today. Adam Manet is the cousin of a hostage who died in captivity. He told Times Radio it's a day of high emotion for families.
The steep joy and the profound chasm of sorrow that every family is going through in one way or another, both for the time away, the loss of memories and time for those who are still alive. And then for those who are dead, the agonizing wait. We still don't know who the four bodies even are.
In other news, Downing Street says allegations the government tried to collapse a trial against two alleged Chinese spies to protect investment in the UK are entirely false. Last week, the Director of Public Prosecution said his requests to label Beijing a threat weren't responded to. Number 10 also denies that National Security Advisor Jonathan Powell was involved in major discussions. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, fears a cover-up.
That seems to be incompetence on the part of the government at best. So they need to explain who knew what, where. And if it is Jonathan Powell who has caused this, then yes, probably he should go.
Security Minister Dan Jarvis will update MPs this afternoon. The European Union's ambassador to Britain has defended planned tariffs of 50% on steel imports to the bloc. Pedro Serrano says the EU will consider country-specific rules and hold talks with countries like the UK. The High Court has heard that car makers would rather cheat than comply with the law. Firms are accused of cheating on emissions tests in what became known as Dieselgate. In one of the biggest legal actions in English history, 1.6 million motorists are taking action. And a new analysis for The Times has found that black Londoners are nearly three times more likely to be strip searched than white people. No illegal items were found in almost half of the 322 cases involving black people, but officers were 11% more likely to find drugs on the 113 white adults. The Metropolitan Police says stop and search is vital for tackling violent crime. For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to The Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So it really is such an important day in geopolitics today, and you'll hear everything that you need to know here on Times Radio. World leaders from more than 20 countries are gathering in Egypt for the peace summit following the ceasefire in Gaza. Donald Trump's been running behind after his speech to Israel's parliament ran hours late. Keir Starmer and the Palestinian Authority's President Mahmoud Abbas are present, but the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not attending. Let's catch up with Greg Karlstrom, who is the Economist Middle East correspondent. Greg, is Netanyahu's absence from these talks quite a bad omen for the future so soon after the start of that future?
I think it's a sign that Benjamin Netanyahu has not changed over the past 2 years. The official reason that his office gave for his refusal to attend the summit was a Jewish holiday, Simchat Torah, which begins at sundown tonight. Typically, Israeli prime ministers don't like to attend public events that conflict with a Jewish holiday. But everyone in Israel I've spoken to thinks, you know, he probably could have done that. He could have gone anyway and cited the importance of the event as a reason to do it on a holiday. I think the real reason he didn't go has more to do with the fact that, for example, he might end up being photographed shaking hands with Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, who was also expected to attend and who is anathema to Netanyahu's far-right voters. So he is still prioritizing his own short-term political interests, particularly now with an election looming next year. He is prioritizing that over any opportunity for sort of a bigger new diplomatic arrangement that might come out of the war.
What do you think realistically these talks will achieve?
It remains to be seen. It's a good question. I think there's one version of this summit where everyone pats themselves on the back for negotiating a ceasefire in Gaza. There are some short-term pledges of aid. I know several countries are going to announce, you know, on the order of $10 million or $20 million for immediate humanitarian needs in Gaza, getting food and medicine into the territory, trying to fix up desalination plants and other critical bits of infrastructure. So that might be all that happens. There's another more hopeful version of this where particularly the Arab leaders who are going to see Donald Trump discuss serious plans for governance, for security, for what Gaza is going to look like after the war, for those forward-looking parts of the 20-point Trump plan that negotiators didn't work out the details of in the talks in Egypt last week. We just don't know yet how extensive this summit is going to be.
It's interesting, Greg, that you say that, you know, this might be all that happens with regard to aid going in. But actually, effecting change on the ground in Gaza is hugely important, isn't it? Because, as we were saying earlier, for tens of thousands of people to now be returning to where their home was, digging through rubble to find bodies of their loved ones, they need around them a sense that that isn't it for them. So any aid that arrives, any help that there is with that situation, is actually, it is a it will cause a ripple effect, won't it?
I think it's very important in the short term. I think whatever relief people were feeling in Gaza when the ceasefire was announced last week, that is going to quickly fade unless they start seeing some material improvement in their quality of life. I think particularly as we get closer to the winters, we get closer to a season when it will be cold, it will be rainy in Gaza. If you have 2 million people who are still living in tents, not seeing much in the way of reconstruction, not getting enough to eat, that is going to obviously be a problem in Gaza. And then I think also some of these other things that need to be talked about, like security in Gaza, like this idea of an Arab peacekeeping force that might go in to provide security. Time is of the essence for those things. We're already seeing Hamas deploying thousands of armed men across the bits of Gaza that it controls. We're seeing reprisal killings and arrests of Hamas critics, of people who are rivals to the group. It's already trying to reassert control over parts of Gaza. And if there isn't a solution to that and a counterweight to that, then what we're likely to see is Hamas entrenching itself the way it did before October 7th.
Sure. And Greg, with your experience and knowledge of the area, tell us a bit more about where you think the strength of the Palestinians is to actually stand up against Hamas, because it's always been wrong to think that everybody in Gaza was a supporter of Hamas. And after everything that has happened, there must be so many people who would be looking towards a different type of leadership in their community.
There are. I mean, that was true even before the war, before October 7th. I've been to Gaza dozens of times. And one thing I noticed over the years was that Hamas was increasingly unpopular. It was seen by a good number of Palestinians in Gaza as being at least partly responsible for the miserable conditions that they were living in. And I think that's only intensified since October 7th. There have been various polls of people living in Gaza. Granted, it's hard to do sort of accurate representative surveys in these conditions, but there have been various polls that have found Hamas is deeply unpopular. People think that Hamas dragged them into a war that it could not win against Israel. But the problem has always been the lack of an alternative. For almost 20 years now, Hamas has had essentially unchallenged rule in Gaza. It was very good at smashing any opposition movements that tried to spring up over the years. And the Palestinian Authority, which governs parts of the occupied West Bank, had no control in Gaza. It wasn't able to set foot there. And the Israeli government acquiesced to that state of affairs and in some cases encouraged it because it wanted to weaken the Palestinian Authority. So I think the question now is, you do have deep support in Gaza for some sort of alternative governance, and that is spelled out, at least in principle, in the Trump plan. But will Arab states get behind it and provide some real support for an alternative government? Will the PA be allowed to have a role? Will Israel allow it to have a role? I think all of those questions are unanswered so far. And unless there is a real alternative presented to people in Gaza, I don't think they're going to be able to, unfortunately, do much about Hamas, which is still the best armed military group in the territory. Yeah.
And Donald Trump says that America had a lot of help from Muslim countries in the peace negotiations. Do you think that that relationship, that goodwill will last?
You hope it will. I think the problem is that for decades now, Arab states have not wanted to get very involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They issue statements, they draw up peace plans, but any sort of active involvement has been viewed as a negative, has been viewed as it's all downside and no upside from the perspective of Arab states. And I think even now, They say they're on board with the Trump plan. They say they're very supportive of what President Trump is trying to do. But when you try to get down to the specifics of, you know, would you send troops, for example, to join a multinational peacekeeping force in Gaza, there's a concern that that might be politically fraught at home, that that peacekeeping force might be seen by many people in this region as working alongside the Israeli army. Even if they're not directly working together, they might be seen as working in parallel. And given how many people in the Arab world think the Israeli army has been committing genocide in Gaza for the past 2 years, that would be a very unpopular decision to send troops to join an Arab peacekeeping force. So the politics of it are complicated, and I think it's going to take some willingness to do the sorts of things that Arab countries have not been willing to do in the past, to do things that might be difficult, might be unpopular, and to agree amongst themselves on exactly what they want the this sort of new Gaza to look like.
Well, we hold our breath a bit, don't we? It's always good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. That's Greg Karlstrom, who's the Economist Middle East correspondent. Let's talk a bit more about aid to Gaza, because as Greg mentioned, countries are pledging renewed aid, with the UK promising £20 million to deliver water and sanitation. The Norwegian Refugee Council is one of the largest aid organisations on the ground, and it's also one of the bodies responsible for spending the UK's cash pledge. And we can talk to the NRC's Ahmed Bayram now. A very good afternoon from us. Can you just tell us your thoughts on what the ceasefire means for the people of Gaza and what you've heard from your people on the ground?
Very much a relief indeed. After 2 years of suffering, people are relieved. And in some sense, still in this disbelief, really, that this is actually happening. I was speaking to a colleague who was telling me that for the first time in 2 years, she could have a bowl of salad. For the first time, she could see, at least compared to what she has been through, enough items on the market. Of course, this is not to lose sight of the catastrophe that Gaza is today, with large-scale damage, people telling us they are going back to nothing. One of my colleagues was telling me how she can now see parts of Israel from her balcony because of so much destruction in Gaza City. She couldn't see it a few weeks ago when she left Gaza. So it's all about saving lives, of course. The mission is going to be very, very huge, and it's only right that the whole world really is thrown behind this mission.
It's hard to understand where you even start with simply the amount of devastation, the amount of rubble across Gaza, the fact that so many people will be returning to homes that are no longer homes. We've seen some of the situations in the hospitals. That doesn't change overnight. So where do you start?
You start with saving lives. The day after should be all about that. Today in Gaza, there are 55,000 children facing acute malnutrition. In other words, they face death if not treated immediately. Treatment doesn't happen with a bag of bread, doesn't happen with a bowl of rice. It happens through sustained supply, long-lasting supply, uninterrupted, of medication, of food, of nutritional supplies, of everything that these people need to survive. They have survived 2 years of bombardment, displacement, destruction, famine. And so we should go in and give everything we can to save lives. We start with opening the borders, I should say here. All crossings, border crossings, aid crossings should open so that aid can gush in. There's so much aid waiting, languishing across five different regions outside Israel and Gaza, including in Egypt, including in Jordan, including at Ashdod port in Cyprus. There are 134,000 tons of food. This could go a long way towards reversing this famine alleviating the suffering on the people.
How do you deal with the fact, as Greg talked about there and many other people have spoken about too, that Gaza's institutions have been taken over by Hamas and there are still fighters there on the streets? There is still a capacity for Hamas to operate. How do your workers navigate that challenge of helping Palestinians in that situation?
Yeah, I think that's why we are calling for guarantees. Obviously, we have been giving aid for 2 years now, independently, neutrally, transparently, of course, with the very limited supply that we had. My colleagues at the Norwegian Refugee Council and indeed across the aid spectrum, where you're putting their lives on the line. I think what we need to see now is guarantees that our aid convoys will cross from point A to point B uninterrupted, transparent, obviously unhindered, so that we make sure that these aid convoys get to the people. It could be through an international mechanism. The same states who have obviously negotiated this deal could negotiate a way to monitor the flow of aid, to make sure that aid is crossing through these points and into these displacement sites. So it's possible. I mean, we have made it work in the last ceasefire. We can make it work, but we need support. We need support not just through funding, but through also ensuring the safety of our aid convoys.
Well, good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed. That is the Norwegian Refugee Council representative, Ahmed Bayram.
Coming up, we're in this together. We'll discuss the latest development in the controversy surrounding the friendship between the Duke of York and the convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. It is Times Radio. It's 18 minutes past three. You're listening to Jane and Fee with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
An awful lot going on in the world. We've got our best autumnal wardrobe on and we're going to face all of the news that's happening. Particular eye, of course, what's going on in Sharm el-Sheikh. News of the peace process emerges. How optimistic should we really be?
And William Hague and Kezia Dugdale will be here with us to go through that story and all the others. Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar, and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone, and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programs and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio, good afternoon to you. Donald Trump's plane has now landed in Egypt. There'll be more coverage on all the events in the Middle East with John Pienaar here on Times Radio between 4 o'clock and 7. Now to the latest development in the controversy surrounding the friendship between the Duke of York and Jeffrey Epstein. It's been revealed that an email from the disgraced prince saying we're in this together and promising that they would, quote, play some more soon, was sent the day after a photograph emerged showing him with his arm around 17-year-old Virginia Giuffre's waist, a time he claims, of course, to have been having no contact at all with Epstein. I've been talking to Andrew Lowney, who's a royal historian and the author of the bestseller entitled The Rise and Fall of the House of York. He told me about the impact all this is having on what's left of Prince Andrew's reputation.
It confirms my own research that the relationship with Epstein went on a lot longer than both Sarah and Andrew have said, had admitted. But it is very damaging. I mean, it's just another of the lies from the Newsnight interview. I think there's a lot more still to come. I'm aware my own research is only the tip of the iceberg, and there's a lot of material that I have which I hope now can come out. We know, for example, that Sarah Ferguson was staying at one of Epstein's flats as late as 2013 and 14. So, I mean, what they say in public and what they do in private are clearly two very different things. And it puts a lot of pressure on the king, because I think there's a very strong public feeling that something needs to be done. I think there needs to be an investigation into Andrew's time as a special trade envoy, which is when he did a lot of his business with Epstein. I think there are grounds now to remove some of his titles and responsibilities. It's ridiculous. He's still a Knight of the Garter, and he's still, I think, an honorary vice admiral and a councillor of state.
I mean, there's nothing remotely honourable about this individual, is there? And you do have to, in a way, I don't know whether you agree with this, Andrew, I'm perplexed by how many people are sort of only dimly aware of the whole saga, or they've just got so used to the idea that he's such a liability, and indeed worse than a liability, that it's not quite the talking point that it should be.
Well, I mean, time and time again, I've been surprised. I mean, there was a 2022 High Court case in which there was £1.3 million of unexplained money paid to the Yorks, and nothing happened really as a result of that. The press hardly covered the story. You know, we had Sarah selling access to Andrew for £500,000 in 2010. It was a sort of weekend scandal, and that was it. And I mean, talking to people, even school friends of Andrew, they say he was an accident waiting to happen. But I think the attitude of the royal family is to sort of hope that the problem goes away, because they don't quite know what to do. And so it's easier to do nothing than address the thing and try and get ahead of the narrative, which is what they need to do. Because I think the danger is that he's now infecting the whole body politic. And, you know, there are calls now for a republic. I don't think that's going to happen. But support for the monarchy is rapidly draining away. And it's undermining the good work that all the other members of the royal family do.
Andrew isn't going to go away, but partly because he's in his, mid-60s. And let's face it, long life is in his genes. He could be staggering around the Windsor estate for the next three decades, couldn't he? But presumably he cannot stay in that huge house, Royal Lodge.
Well, I think the problem is he can, because he's got a pretty ironclad lease. But you're right, the optics look terrible, and somehow he needs to be persuaded to move. I mean, there are options for him. I mean, he could go into exile in the way that Duke of Windsor did. He has been offered a palace in Abu Dhabi. We had the Rwanda scheme. Could we not reinstate that for Andrew? So there are places where he could quietly hide away and be forgotten. But you're right. You know, he could go on for a long time. You know, I think if he was to come forward and perhaps, you know, give an interview where he actually told the truth, that would go to some way to satisfying public opinion. Because at the moment, the worry, I think, particularly for the royal family, is that there's more stuff to come out. We have Virginia Giffrey's book. We have the memoirs of a woman called Juliet Bryant. We have clearly congressmen now prepared to name names. We're going to have more of these leaks coming. I think what I found is this is a big part of a huge network, and you know, a lot of names that were taken out of the hardback, you know, for example, like Peter Mandelson, are clearly involved in this. I mean, there are a lot of people feeding in these waters.
Right. In the meantime, you suggest that Prince Andrew will need to be persuaded to move out of Royal Lodge, for example. Why can't he simply be ordered to get out? He must know. I know he's got an absolutely mind-boggling lack of self-awareness, but even someone as daft as him must realise how much damage he's doing to the royal brand. Shouldn't they just tell him to go?
Well, they can't. I mean, it's owned by the Crown Estates, which is sort of meant to be sort of arm's length. And, you know, the lease is pretty secure there. As long as he upholds the fabric of the house, then he can stay. This is his last bit of royal status, really. And for him, everything is about status. He has very little sense of his own identity. I mean, he describes himself as a prince first, a naval officer second, and a husband third. Well, he kind of failed at the second and third. But this is the one thing he can still hang on to, and he wants to be able to pass it on to his children, I think. And he has, as we saw at Duchess of Kent's funeral, very little sense of self-awareness or an ability to read the room. And he's stubborn, and you know, he thinks there's no reason for him to go, so he won't go.
The Duchess of Kent's funeral, and it's a great shame for her that her funeral was overshadowed by this, but was notable because Andrew made a determined effort to be seen to be talking in public to Prince William, who could not have looked less delighted to be involved. That was pretty awful to look at. It was rather grotesque, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, you know, the royal family clearly are embarrassed by him. The danger is that they almost need to keep him close for worry that he might do something dramatic. I mean, there are always worries that there'll be an Andrew Morton figure who will release stories that they prefer not to come out. But yes, I mean, he was, you know, hoping to get a bit of attention. I mean, the ridiculous thing is that King Charles seems to have allowed him to have a police escort from Windsor to the funeral. He was given a front row seat. So in some ways, it's not just Prince Andrew, but I think other members of the institution, I mean, in the office, who need to reconsider how they're treating him. You know, they are way behind public opinion on this.
So do you think the king then is partly responsible and perhaps needs to have a confrontation and actually deal with his brother one-on-one?
Well, I think there have been attempts to do this. I mean, he thought that he could push him out of Royal Lodge. There were assurances that Andrew could afford to live there. The problem is you can't believe anything Andrew says. I don't think he told the truth entirely about the Newsnight interview to his family. I don't think he's been entirely open about his sources of wealth to them. There needs to be a bit more due diligence. The palace is filled with former spooks. I think they should be reporting. But my own research showed that when the spooks did report to the Queen and the Queen's private secretary, that nothing was done. He was protected, and he knows he's protected.
And as you say, there is that real risk that he could, he likes money, he could take a juicy offer from a publisher and tell all. Although you might know more than me, Andrew, but I'm not quite sure what all would amount to. Can you give us some hints?
Well, I mean, I don't know either, but, you know, clearly there are perhaps embarrassing episodes in the family's history, perhaps relating to Queen, Prince Philip, King Charles, who knows, Harry and Meghan. You know, there must be stories there that are of interest that he's not related. This was always the worry with Sarah Ferguson, which is why they kept her close over the years. You know, we don't know what we don't know, but I suspect there are a lot of secrets that they have which could be divulged, which would be very damaging to the monarchy. I mean, the irony is in my book entitled, I end the book by saying that Andrew, who claims to be a great supporter of the monarchy, could be actually one of the instruments that brings it down. And it seems these events are playing in very much to that argument.
And the next looming deadline, if you like, for Andrew will be the late Virginia Giuffre's book.
Yes, it's out next week. As I said, there are other books coming out. I think a more serious one called Blue Butterfly next month. But, you know, people are now prepared to talk. Things are beginning to emerge. And I only think it can get worse for the royal family and for Andrew.
Andrew Lowney making it clear that this particular tawdry saga is far from over. His book is called Entitled, The Rise and Fall of the House of York, and it's out now.
So we were both saying earlier, weren't we, that we would like to see Prince Andrew face the challenge of a man in his 60s just getting a job.
Absolutely.
Like everybody else has to if they fall on difficult times.
Perhaps looking for a place to live in the Windsor area.
Maybe. Let's check Zoopla. Jane and Fiat Times dot radio is our email address. We are 0333 00 3 2353. Coming up, more and more people are paying for private healthcare in the UK. Our money doctor, Adam Shaw, is going to tell us what this means. You're listening to Jane and Fiat on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk. Let's get the very latest news. It's just gone 3:30.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Donald Trump has landed in Egypt for the Gaza Peace Summit. Earlier, he was greeted with a standing ovation at Israel's parliament, where he spoke of an historic dawn for the Middle East. Earlier, all 20 living Israeli hostages were released by Hamas and reunited with their families. But Israel's defense minister has hit out at the militant group as the remains of only 4 dead hostages have been handed over. Political analyst Aryeh Kovler in Jerusalem says authorities hoped more would come home today.
They're saying they can only find 4 today. That's a lot less than Israel had been led to believe would be handed back today. And now there's kind of urgent talks going on about what this means for this current tranche of prisoner releases. I mean, there's a lot of challenges ahead, and they're already starting.
Elsewhere, Conservative Party leader Kemi Badenoch has accused the government of a cover-up over a failed China spy trial. Number 10 has rejected suggestions the government influenced the collapse of the case over concerns Beijing could withdraw investment. The High Court has been told car manufacturers decided to cheat rather than follow laws on emissions as the biggest legal action of its kind in England gets underway. Lawyers for the more than a dozen companies involved deny fitting technology. And Ollie Watkins has been ruled out of England's Football World Cup qualifier with Latvia tomorrow. The striker picked up a knee injury in last week's friendly against Wales. Remember, the finest writers from The Times preview and review the week's football on The Game podcast.
This is Times Radio.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry, there was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only thing she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Take advantage of the Kia Electric Car Allowance to drive the Kia EV3, this year's UK and World Car of the Year. Or the new EV4, the Times Electric Car of the Year 2025, with a range of up to 388 miles. Get up to £3,750 towards your PCP finance deposit contribution and 3.9% APR representative until the 16th of December. Search the Kia Electric Car Allowance today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Range based on test conditions and may vary. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Ready to start your next home project? This autumn at Wix, there are great kitchen and bathroom offers available. Explore the ranges at wix.co.uk or visit the showroom in your local Wix store.
Times Radio. We're on. We are, Fee, aren't we?
We are, and it's time now to enter our literary salon. This week, it's for those of us who tend to purchase a new book whilst ignoring the unopened ones we already have. Laura Hackett is the Deputy Literary Editor at the Times and Sunday Times and is here to tell us about her new No New Books rule.
Oh. Well, my No New Books rule is a rule I have for holidays. And I'm quite recently back from holiday, although it feels like a distant memory. I basically did that weird thing where I took no time off the first half of the year, now I'm having to use it all up.
Right.
But this was quite nice. I was in Ischia, off Italy. And so one of the things I wanted to read was one of the Elena Ferrante novels, The Neapolitan Quartet, which I love so much, but I've been dragging them out over several years because I couldn't bear for it to be over. It's now over. I read the last one. A little tear came in my eye. I felt sort of hungover afterwards, like I wasn't ready to read another book. But this is my recommendation to, wherever possible, tailor your reading to where you're going. Because there were times when I was reading the book, sitting on the beach, and the characters would also be on the beach. And that was very cool. That was really fun. So that's my recommendation.
I think that's such a good recommendation because you can properly lose yourself. It's like surround sound, isn't it, if you read something written by or about the place that you're in. For people who haven't come across Elena Ferrante's novels or have and thought, oh my goodness, everyone's just banging on about these things, I can't get into them myself, what's the magic for you?
I think it's the way she conjures up that world. It's all the tiny details. So it's sort of mid-20th century Naples from a quite rough neighbourhood. That's where the two girls whose friendship we follow over many years, that's where they're born and where they grew up and where they keep being drawn back to. And there are so many details, whether it's the food they eat, the clothes they wear, the toys that they play with. It's such a kind of foreign world for so many of the readers, I'm sure, but it really, really comes to life in the way that she describes it. And I also think it's quite nice the way that Ferrante, at the core of this, it's not essentially about a romantic relationship. It's not really about family. It's about these two friends and how their lives keep getting drawn back to one another. And I just really loved that it put female friendship at the heart of it.
Jill, I'm slightly put off by the title of the fourth and final instalment, The Story of the Lost Child. Just on a rating of 1 to 10, where 10 is you can't get up off your sun lounger because you're so bereft, and 1 is, wahey, bring me another martini. Where is this?
I wasn't ordering more martinis. There is a very tense point at which the title, it becomes clear why it is called that. And that at that moment, you really cannot get up off the sun lounger. But there's a big lead up to it. And then there's also a big part afterwards. I would say there's probably about 20 or 30 pages of true tension. I can't put this book down. Do not talk to me. I don't care that I'm on holiday with you. But that's what makes it so great, if obviously also quite distressing.
Okay. From Italy to Ireland, you've also been reading A Pagan Place by Edna O'Brien.
So I feel like Edna O'Brien's having a real moment, and not just in my life, but potentially also in other people's lives.
Jane, is she in yours, darling?
Well, she was a brilliant woman. I have to say, I'm not over familiar with her work.
You need to get to me.
I know. She died relatively recently,
she
didn't
did. She? She died a couple of years ago. There was a documentary film that came out about her earlier this year, which is fantastic. It's called The Blue Road. Mm. And Faber are also kind of republishing some of her books, so hopefully they'll reach a wider audience. But this one is slightly lesser known. It's called A Pagan Place. I can see why it's lesser known. It's all in the second person, which, if you've ever been to a single creative writing class, basically the first rule they tell you is never use the second person, which is obviously you said this, you did this, because after about 50 words, it gets really grating.
You're not selling this. So.
But okay. It doesn't here. Oh. It sort of, it just blends into the story and you don't even notice that it's all you. And in fact, you, the reader, end up being so brought into the thick of it that you can really sense the tension. It's basically a young woman who's decided to leave home and become a nun, looking back on her childhood in rural Ireland. It's sort of the 1950s. And the little details about what life was like are really extraordinary, especially what life was like for women. So there's stuff about her sister who's moved away, coming home pregnant, and the uproar and the priest getting involved and the doctor coming around, and the doctor's drunk, but he's doing an examination, and all of this kind of stuff. The mother using tissue paper as contraception. Now, that was one I hadn't heard about before, but it's those details that another writer might not want to look at. But Edna O'Brien always looked at and always gave you those details. And at points it's harrowing, I will say that. Mm. But it's just such an evocative story and you get really drawn into it because I think of that second person narration.
Yeah, I mean, you've just illustrated with that description why she was so controversial in Ireland. Yeah. Can you imagine?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Those are the things that people, I think, like to brush under the carpet, but she refused to do that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She would put them centre stage, and that's just why I admire her so much.
I'd never heard that critique of the second person before. I hadn't really thought about it, but I don't know. Do you find it annoying to have you did that?
I would, I think. Well, I suppose only because I've never come across it.
So yes, I'm not sure that I would mind it, really. Do you mind it?
You know, it doesn't happen very often because people are told don't do it. But I think the first few pages, I thought this is going to be hard going. Am I going to get through this whole book? And then there just came a point where I stopped noticing it. So I think it only really works if you don't notice it.
Yeah.
If you're sitting there the whole time thinking, well, I didn't do that actually. You know, stop telling me I said this and I did that when I didn't do it. If you stop noticing it, then it just works.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not being facetious here. Is it a short book?
It's fairly short. Yeah. 150 pages,
yeah.
Maybe?
So she gets a lot said in a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And finally, On Beauty by Zadie Smith, which is a modern classic, isn't it?
It is. And this one I was slightly cheating with the no new books because Zadie Smith has a collection of essays out in a few weeks' time called Dead or Alive. And I thought, I really need to read another Zadie Smith book. I've only read a couple of them. And everyone was telling me this one's really good. And I really loved it. It's about these two families, the Belsey family and the Kipps family. And the two fathers of the family are both sort of art historians, but they're rivals. And this is set across London and in America. and it goes back and forth. And it's a really wonderful campus novel, but also family saga, because Howard Belsey, who's sort of the head of one of the families, is not a very nice man. He's cheating on his wife and she's finding out about it. And then the children are having their own intrigues. And it's one of those books, kind of like a Dickens novel. I've often felt that Zadie Smith is quite Dickensian, the way she writes, that seemingly minor characters gain significance and end up being a really crucial part of the plot. And it just concludes as this massive jigsaw puzzle all coming together, and it's really satisfying.
Yeah. Mm. And it's also quite wonderful, isn't it, about kind of bursting the bubble of pretension, of all of the respect that can come along if you achieve greatness in academia, which for those of us who've never achieved greatness academia, no, because quite often you do look at that world and you kind of go, what are you all on about? Mm. Why are you all on pedestals here?
It really punctures it. Some of the scenes where Howard is lecturing and he's using all this highfalutin language, and it gives you the perspective of the students, and they're just going, what's he on about? And you're like, well, why is he talking like that? He doesn't need to. That's just sort of part of the language people use to show that they're in that sphere.
Exactly, and it's very revered. Exclusive. It's very elitist, and we should just make it stop. Thank you very much. It's always lovely to see you. Laura, when's your next holiday?
I might actually go home over half term to see my little brother when he's off from school.
Ah, and it's Northern Ireland you're talking
Northern
about.
Ireland, lovely. Yeah.
Okay, well, what will the weather be like?
Terrible, yeah. Doubtless. Okay.
Well, enjoy your trip. So we've been talking about The Story of the Lost Child by Eleanor Ferrante. We also talked about A Pagan Place by Edna O'Brien. And finally, we talked about On Beauty by Zadie Smith.
Yes, at the moment, I'm reading a book called A Sting in Her Tail, which I do recommend. It's a rather a taut little thriller. It's quite short, but it's very pacey. It's by a man called Mark Ezra. And it's about a retired MI6 agent who's a woman who takes quite literally no prisoners and goes about her business very briskly indeed. But it's good.
Excellent. Really good recommendation.
Yeah.
I just completely wolfed down The Hawk is Dead by Peter James. He is a guest on the programme in a couple of weeks' time. I think he's sold 23 million books. He's one of those whopper crime fiction merchants.
And this is set
it's an assassination attempt on Queen Camilla.
Oh. But we
it's
should
set
say
in the royal household.
She has cooperated.
Yes, so Camilla is Peter James's number one fan.
Right.
So okay. They have communicated together, but it's quite a peek behind the curtains. I was going to say net curtains, but they wouldn't have that at the palace. It's very common. So we will look forward to talking to Peter when he's on.
And if you are a listener to Off Air with Jane and Fee, our podcast, we have got a book club podcast edition coming up relatively soon, although not that soon because I haven't read the book yet. And it's Patti Smith's memoir, Just Kids, which is a book suggested by the readers. That's the listeners to the podcast. That's what we do on our podcast, Laura. We ask the listeners to get involved and to nominate a book that they've enjoyed. It doesn't have to be new. In fact, it can't be new, can it? But Just Kids has, to say the least, divided the public, I think it's fair to say. I'm going to ask you, Laura, have you read it?
I haven't, but I know it's iconic. It's one of those ones you always see people reading, like, on the tube or on the train.
Yeah, I think it's one of those books they sold in Urban Outfitters.
Yeah, that's the one.
Not always necessarily a good recommendation for the likes of me. But you've read it, haven't you? Hold on.
Well, I haven't finished it yet, and I've really struggled with it, actually. I think I find, and this is just a personal opinion, I find there's nothing more boring than people describing other people's drug-taking experiences. I just couldn't give a flying what's it.
No.
I'm not interested, and the drugs don't work. Don't do it, kids.
Right, thank you very much. Do listen to what Auntie Fee is saying. Okay, Laura, thank you very much indeed. The Literary Salon, we used to say in the summer that we were throwing open the French windows. What's the autumnal and wintry equivalent?
Making sure the cat flap's closed.
Absolutely, and we'll carry on doing that right through until probably realistically late May. Right, coming up, more and more people are paying for private healthcare in this country. Our money man, Adam Shaw, will tell us what you should look out for if you are thinking of doing exactly that, buying a private health policy. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
It's the world's longest running literature festival. showcasing literary legends, fresh new voices, and the biggest books of the year. The Times, Sunday Times, and Times Radio Cheltenham Literature Festival is back for 2025. And Times Radio will bring you all the sights and sounds of the festival direct from Cheltenham. From the stars of stage and screen to incisive political debate, hear everything the festival has to offer throughout the Times Radio schedule. And this Wednesday from noon, Hugo Rifkin brings you a special PMQs Unpacked live from Cheltenham, only on Times Radio.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Nobody asks to have a lifetime of memories slowly erased. Nobody asks to have a loved one not recognize them. Nobody asks to feel lonely and confused. But today, you could change this. By leaving a gift in your will to Alzheimer's Society, you'll help fund life-changing support, vital campaigning, and groundbreaking research to tackle Britain's biggest killer. Discover the impact your gift can make. Search Alzheimer's Society Wills.
Take advantage of the Kia Electric Car Allowance to drive the Kia EV3, this year's UK and World Car of the Year. Or the new EV4, the Times Electric Car of the Year 2025, with a range of up to 388 miles. Get up to £3,750 towards your PCP finance deposit contribution and 3.9% APR representative until the 16th of December. Search the Kia Electric Car Allowance today.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Range based on test conditions and may vary. T's and C's apply. Kia Finance.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
12 minutes to four. Now, around 7.5 million adults in Britain pay for private medical insurance. That's about 40% of the population, and that figure is very much on the rise. 900,000 more people have bought private health insurance since 2020. I mean, that date is probably not insignificant. Private health can be very expensive, but as NHS waiting lists rise, more people have clearly decided it's worth it. So let's bring in our personal finance guru, our money doctor, Adam Shaw, who's here to explain what you should look out for if you are thinking of doing exactly this. I do imagine that 2020 was a time when we were all thinking about our health.
Yes, of course. I mean, I think it was a push and pull factors going on here. You had the NHS really under huge pressure and a lot of people worried and a change in lifestyles, people being sort of stuck at home and being isolated and all sorts of things coming together. So I think you're absolutely right. That was a sort of lots of things going on. But I think there is a wider and not particularly well-explained pattern going on as well, because it's supporting the governments of various colours. They have pushed in a lot of extra money to the NHS. They really have. We have more nurses, we have more doctors. It is one of the areas of the budget which has grown in real terms quite significantly. And yet, despite all of that, NHS waiting lists are rising very significantly. I don't think we've hit some deadlines for people with really serious problems being dealt with. We haven't hit those deadlines for years now. And we really clearly see waiting lists rising. Now, why? You can chuck a lot more money in and the service doesn't improve. And indeed, perceptions, national surveys about our perceptions of the NHS have collapsed. We're really unhappy with it in a way we haven't been in the past. So,
can I just put this point to you just before we get into some of the detail of this? It's from a listener who just says, I think they're all cowboys, she says. I'm a healthy, fit 75-year-old, but I've had quotes up to about $7,000 a year on the assumption I'm about to fall apart. Now she says, I just pay for tests when I want, then I go to the NHS to join the queue to get some niggles sorted.
Yeah, no, look, and I don't think that's a bad approach at all. You can buy insurance, but especially if you're getting older, and, you know, I'm 60 and
you're not 60.
Well, I think I'm 61 or 62. I can't remember.
Adam,
that's how old I am. Anyway,
someone check Wiki.
Yeah, So, and as you get older, the sort of premiums rise. And I know with my dad, we got to a stage where he was quite ill. And it was actually, we did the same as that listener. We're just so expensive to get the insurance. You just went, that's pointless. We'll just pay for the operations. And of course, if you take that view, whatever age you are, you can do something with that money. So you create your own little pot.
Yeah.
Go, that's my health pot. And I'm going to feed a bit of money into that. Well, it's still my money. It's not disappeared. If I don't need it, I've got that money. Mm. But if I do need it, there's a pot. The problem with that approach is not if you've got a small thing, but if you have a very major operation, that can be blindingly expensive. I mean, that really can be problematic.
Right.
So that's fine if you don't sort of have something big. But if you suddenly have a big operation, it can suddenly cost you an awful lot of money.
Okay, so just to make that clear, it is an entirely valid thing to do.
I think so, just absolutely.
Put some money away every single month. That can be your health fund, and therefore you don't need private health cover.
Correct.
Or hopefully you won't need it. The plain fact is, though, that many of us have perhaps become aware, perhaps through the experience of a friend or a relative, that it might not be a bad thing to have in our locker if we have that money we can put aside every month.
Yes.
How do you get advice on who are the best people to go with?
Well, it's complex because, as with all insurance policies, what we tend to do is compare the price. And there are plenty of places you go to the comparison websites and compare the price.
Mm.
More difficult here, actually, than most insurance policies is you've got to go, we're not comparing like for like. And the price range is very broad indeed. So you want to be really clear about what you're comparing. And the policies will range from just out care, nice and, you know, relative, nothing's cheap, but relatively cheap just for day sort of care, to I want to choose what hospital I go to, I want to be in, I want to have for everything paid.
What you could honestly specify with some of these policies which hospital.
Well, it will grade the hospitals and places, and so you'll get the more flexibility you incorporate into the policy, the more expensive it is. And our listener there was talking about, I think, seven grand a year. I mean, I know people who are paying 10 grand a year.
Really?
For their policies. To be fair, that's a family policy. But it can be very, very expensive. And if you want to reduce the amount you're paying, you sort of just have less flexibility in your choices.
Can I ask something which you may not be able to answer? If you do have a private health insurance policy and you use it to diagnose something, are you then just entitled to go back into the NHS and say, I'd like you to treat me here, this is what they say I've got?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's often actually very prevalent issue if you get prescribed. So you go to your private consultant and they prescribe you medication, and you suddenly go, well, hey, hold on a second, I don't want to pay a private prescription here, I'd like an NHS prescription. Mm. Now, it's actually not that clear, but I've seen from lots of individual health authorities guidance to their local doctors and going, no, a private doctor cannot issue you with an NHS prescription. What you can do is take that diagnosis and go to your GP and go, I've been diagnosed like this under the NHS. If this medication is allowable under the NHS, will you accept that diagnosis and can you now prescribe me? And that would, if you can do that, that would be much cheaper for the individual. But in a sense of fairness, what the nation doesn't want to end up doing is getting people who can afford to get private health consultation, suddenly that cost now to be borne by the NHS and getting a service that those who can't afford that sort of can't get. So there are limitations, but if you are going down the private health route, you are prescribed medication, a thing you should consider is going to your NHS GP, showing them that diagnosis and asking them whether they're prepared to give you an NHS prescription.
So can I ask about pre-existing conditions? Mm. When you first apply for private health, you've got to be totally honest, haven't you?
Yes.
I mean, you'd be mad not to. It's no good saying, oh, I'm a non-drinker.
Yeah.
When in fact, you're most definitely not. And you can't say you've never smoked if you have.
Well, and also, just if you've been diagnosed with things, if you have a recurring problem or have had a problem in the past, and perhaps you're fine now, but it might recur. If you don't admit that and that recurs, then you could find yourself having paid all of those those premiums actually not covered. So you'd be in the worst possible situation. It would cost you a fortune and you don't have proper insurance. So to be fair to the insurance companies and to make sure you're doing the right thing, you do, as with all things, to be honest, I mean, you do have to be honest about this. If you are not, you could find yourself in big trouble.
Right. And some people do take a chance, don't they? And you really, it's so crazy to do that. It really
is. I mean, with all things, I mean, one has to behave properly. I mean, it's whether or not it comes back to haunt you is a separate issue. It's a practical issue. But insurance and society is based on us being honest with each other. And insurance works that way. So I think actually you'll probably get caught, but that's a side issue. One should be honest.
Yeah. Now, some companies will offer a perk or two. Can you tempt us with any of these?
Well,
what are they?
One, especially if you're in London, I see the adverts on the tubes all the time, Vitality Health, offer Apple Watches for a massive discount.
Well, are they the ones that tell you how much quality sleep you've had the night before?
I think that and how many steps you've done and your blood pressure and all sorts of things.
You become a bit neurotic about that sort of thing.
Well, like, I think there's a wider issue about measuring stuff all the time, going, oh, I failed to do my steps again. You sort of feel worse about it. I think that's a bigger issue. But a lot of them feel, well, look, actually, if we can persuade you to be healthy and go to the gym, you're less likely to use our services. So it's not sort of a gift for them. It's sort of self-interest.
Fancy so, that.
So lots of them do. Bupa give you a free dental practice. AXA Health and Aviva both have, I think, discounts on gym services as well. So if you're with them, you get a bit of a discount off your local gym.
All right. Just looking, one listener, Alex, says he's 66 and he pays about £2,200 a year for private health, which he says includes travel insurance. Right. And another listener, Christopher, can you remind Adam that there are private healthcare schemes available from various companies for the likes of civil servants and indeed those who work in the NHS and police emergency services? Yeah,
there are group schemes. And actually, I did join a group scheme at one point where the company I worked for sort of put together something that you paid for and they shared the risk amongst everybody that worked for that scheme. So that worked for that company. So that, yes, if you are looking for this, do ask your, first of all, your employer whether there's a shared scheme that you can join, and indeed the provider, whether there's a sort of a similar scheme. And that can be a cheaper way of doing it.
It would seem extraordinary, though, that NHS workers have private healthcare.
Well, I don't see why. I mean, just because you have private healthcare doesn't mean that you're anti the NHS.
In fact, you could put the argument, couldn't you, that you were helping the NHS?
You could argue. I mean, it's a complex argument because you're going, well, I'm not on an NHS waiting list. On the other hand, people would argue, hold on, but the doctors who are treating you are now not treating someone on the NHS. So I think that this is not a black and white situation here.
Thank you, Adam. I think we are going to have to go to President Trump, who has arrived in Egypt. Here he is.
And they have very little crime, you know, because they don't play games. That's why. They don't play games like we do in the United States with governors that have no idea what they're doing. But they don't have crime. I ask about crime and they almost don't even know what I'm talking about. So it's a great tribute to this man. He's done a fantastic job in bringing this country together. And the United States is with him all the way. Thank you. Okay, all the way. And it's an honor to be with you.
Sir, what will Egypt's role play in the peace process here?
He played a very important role, and they had a very important role with Hamas. In fact, the general was right here, was very instrumental because Hamas respects this country and they respect the leadership of Egypt. So he played a very important role. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thank you. President Trump, in Israel just now, you were talking about a possible Iran peace deal. You said, we are ready when you are. Yeah. Is that the ultimate goal with today's signing, to get enough?
Not Iran, but I think Iran will come along. They've been battered and bruised, and, you know, they need some help. They have big sanctions, as you know, tremendous sanctions. I'd love to take the sanctions off when they're ready to talk. But they can't really survive with those sanctions. Those sanctions are very tough. But at some point, they're going to say, we want the sanctions off. We're going to end up with peace. I think Iran is going to be fine. I know so many Iranian people. They're great people. They're smart, great, great people. Engineers, lawyers. I mean, they're academics. But they took a big hit. And frankly, If we didn't hit them with the nuclear, I don't think you would have been able to have this incredible, this deal, this once-in-a-lifetime deal. Nobody's ever seen anything like what's happening today. And countries have all come together, all different countries. Some liked each other, some didn't, most didn't. And they've all come together. Every country has come together. And by the way, Iran did put out a statement, you know, that they support this deal very wholeheartedly. So that was in itself something. But no, I think they want to, that's all I do in my life, I make deals. And they want to make a deal.
President Trump,
now that the living hostages have been returned, can you please tell us what the next steps are?
Well, they're going and looking for bodies. It's a pretty gruesome task. And they know where numerous are, as you know. I guess 5 or 6 are in yet now. But they're looking for bodies. They know the areas and the search parties out. And they're doing it in conjunction with Israel. And they're going to be finding quite a few of them.
President Trump, can you tell us when phase 2 of the negotiations will begin?
Well, it started. I mean, it started as far as we're concerned. Phase 2 has started. And, you know, the phases are all a little bit mixed in with each other. They're going to start cleaning up. You look at Gaza, and it needs a lot of cleanup. That's why when I talked in my speech, I talked about the debris. I used the word debris. That's debris times 10. So, but they're going to really do a job. They have a lot of power. In another room, you have some of the wealthiest nations in the world. All leaders, the big leaders are here, the emirs and the kings and everybody, and it's a very interesting group. I guess we have like 35 countries, and that's only because they were the 35 that we invited. Everybody that we invited came. So there's a lot of respect. And I think you'll see some tremendous progress, both in the Middle East. This country is doing very well. It has good leadership. It's about leadership. And it's really nice when you say, how is your crime situation? And they like don't even know what you're talking about. What do you mean crime? We don't have crime. Because if he has crime, he puts it out very quickly. Some people think that's not nice, but I think it's great. Because people don't want to be mugged and smashed, and they don't want to be stupid people. They have a place that is doing very well. We're very proud of him. Because we knew each other from the beginning. The first time I met, it was in a hotel, and I was going to meet him, and then Hillary Clinton was following me. Remember that? Hillary Clinton. And he liked me so much, he never even got to see Hillary. He saw her for about 2 seconds. But he didn't really want to waste a lot of time. He knew what was going to happen. But that was the first time we met, and we had a very good chemistry together. And it continues till today. So I want to thank you all very much. I appreciate the way you covered this really momentous. I've never seen anything like it. The level of love, the level of respect for what it is. And it's, you know, it's peace in the Middle East. And everybody said it's not possible to do. And it's going to happen. And it is happening. It's before your very eyes. And that's why it's become so fascinating. Marco, do you have anything to say?
Egypt's been a phenomenal participant. I think both Steve and Jared will tell you the critical role they played, and they can tell you themselves. They hosted the talks here, and they're going to play a very important role now in the follow-up, the implementation of this, which is really, it's not simply about restoring Gaza, it is about transforming the region. So we have an incredible partner, a long alliance, a very capable partner here, and a tremendous collection of leaders. This is clearly, in my mind, I think in the mind of everyone in this room, probably one of the most important days for world peace in 50 years. That's not an exaggeration.
Only 50?
Maybe 100. Certainly since the end of World War II, Mr. President.
Mr. Witkoff and Mr. Kushner, I'm curious, you've played such an important role in the tactical negotiations here. What will your role be going forward as a lot more has to be brought to the table here?
Oh, the minute we had inked the deal, Jared and I were already working on the implementation side of the deal. So, We've dug in. We'll be here quite a bit. That's at the direction of the president. That's probably going to be one of the most important phases here. Jared is remarkable to work with. I talk about it all the time. And, of course, we both love working for the president. So it's feels like a very honorable job.
Mr. President, would you like to say something with the interpreter?
Yes. What if today I'm going to have the Muhammad Rice? I'm going to say it with
خیلی شراب بود بس شراب میشه دیمس بس وقت خود تا بس نه اسم بس بود کل مصری ممکن حتی با کل محب سره نرجو لك التحية والاحترام على تحية هذا الإنجاز الرائع.
I'm John Pienaar. This is Drive on Times Radio. We're listening live to President Trump sitting alongside President al-Sisi of Egypt in Sharm el-Sheikh, where world leaders have gathered for the next part of today's ceremonies and formalities, the signing of the deal to bring peace to the Middle East. We're going to stay with this a little longer, and then we will have more for you here on Drive.
I respect this unprecedented and momentous accomplishment by our hands.
أنا كنت متأكد فخر الرئيس. أنا كان الوحيد القادر على تحقيق هذا الإنجاز وإنهاء.
I've been very confident that Your Excellency is the only one who's capable of bringing this about and bring an end to this war.
وأنا في خلال اتصالي بفخامة الرئيس ذكرت له ذلك بدل قلت لفخامة الرئيس أنت وحدك القادر على تحقيق السلام في منطقتنا.
I even said that very precisely during my communication with Your Excellency that you are the only one who is able to bring about peace and to achieve peace in this part.
بشكرك فخامة الرئيس.
I thank you.
ولكن عايزين نستكمل نسبب إطلاق النار
We're going to put away there from that live spray, as they're called, the two leaders side by side talking to the media in Sharm el-Sheikh. They're going to go on to meet another, 30 or so world leaders for the signing of the deal that has been agreed, the plan, the 21-point plan for returning stability and peace to the Middle East. And we'll just bring you this, just dropping as I speak. It is from the Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz, speaking on the social media platform X. And he says in this post, the urgent mission to which we're committed is to ensure the return of all the abducted bodies, get them home.